This is Houston Matters. I'm Craig Cohen. Good morning. Coming up this hour, the mother of a transgender child on why she moved her family out of Texas, what a new poll tells us about Texans' attitudes towards health care, and the late Mickey Gilley remembering his Pasadena honky tonk and the film that made it famous. First, though, every Tuesday we offer you an opportunity to talk directly with an area elected official. And today we welcome back to the program Houston area Congresswoman Lizzie Fletcher. She's a Democrat representing the Texas 7th Congressional District on the west side of Houston. Congresswoman Fletcher, good morning.
Good morning, Craig. I'm glad to be with you.
While I have questions for the Congresswoman, really this time is for you, so I hope that you will email your questions to talk@HoustonMatters.org, or you can call us now at 713-440-8870. Congresswoman, you attended protests in Houston last week after that Supreme Court draft opinion and a case that could overturn Roe v. Wade was leaked. You're also a co-sponsor of the Women's Health Protection Act and have been calling for the Senate to pass a version of it to codify abortion rights. But Congress has had nearly 50 years to do that and hasn't. Why would anything change now?
Well, Craig, thanks so much for raising this issue. I think it's really important, and I know it's on the minds of so many people here in the district. I've been home in the district over the last week and have had the chance to talk to so many people who are outraged and devastated and deeply concerned about what we saw in the draft opinion that was leaked from the Supreme Court last week. And you're right, this is a time where we need to see our legislatures acting to protect the health, privacy, dignity, and freedom that Roe v. Wade has provided and really represented for the last 50 years. What we've seen is the opposite. I think, unfortunately, many people believed that the courts would never overturn these fundamental freedoms that are embodied in Roe, which basically is, in my view, is very consistent with our values as Texans in terms of our individual liberty, our individual autonomy to control our own lives. And so what we've seen now is that Congress has acted. The House of Representatives voted in September, shortly after SB 8 here in Texas went into effect. And we saw then that the Supreme Court did not grant an emergency stay of that law. The House of Representatives mobilized and voted on the Women's Health Protection Act. I was an original co-sponsor of that bill, and it essentially codifies Roe v. Wade. Why hasn't Congress done it for the last 50 years? I'm not sure, because I haven't been there, but I know now that we have a pro-choice majority and we have constituents. I have constituents in my district, and my colleagues have people across the country who are deeply concerned about undoing this right that we have had for the last 50 years. And also, important to note, this opinion undoes the rationale and the basis, the right to privacy, that doesn't extend only to abortion. You know, Roe came out of a series of cases in the 1960s, including one in 1962 that said married couples had a right to privacy that would allow them to use birth control. This draft opinion undoes that right to privacy, and it is really, it is a radical move. It is a radical change to how we live our lives today. And the answer now is we need to make sure that our legislatures are hearing us loud and clear. Certainly we are hearing in Congress about how important it is to protect these rights. And it is up to our elected officials in the states and in the federal government to do that now.
Let's dive right into calls. We have Philip on the line from River Oaks who wanted to ask you about this. Philip, go ahead with your question.
Sure. Yes. Hey, Lizzie, it's Philip.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, my question was, does Lizzie think that the Senate will indeed pass, or are they going to try and filibuster it again like they have so many other bills?
Well, I don't know exactly what will happen in the Senate, but as it sounds like you probably know, you have to have 60 votes in the United States Senate to pass legislation. That's how you get past the filibuster. And we know that the Senate is going to vote this week. As I said, we passed the Women's Health Protection Act back in September. The Senate has taken it up once before and did not pass it then. Senator Schumer, who's the majority leader in the Senate, has said that he's setting it for a vote tomorrow on Wednesday. And then we'll see where everyone stands in the Senate now that we have seen where the Supreme Court appears to be going. Of course, I do think it's important to note this was a leaked draft opinion This is not the final opinion for people who have appointments. Abortion is still legal in this moment in the United States, but we have seen where the court is headed. And that has mobilized people across our community and across our country. I think what we will see in the Senate will reflect important information for voters as they go to the polls in November about where their senators stand on protecting our fundamental autonomy, freedom, and liberty.
Thanks very much for that call. And to that end, Congresswoman, polling shows a majority of Americans do favor some degree of abortion rights. What's not clear is whether it is still the wedge issue that it once was and will prompt some wave of support for Democrats in November, as some of your colleagues hope. If it does not, as various state laws take effect, including one here in Texas that would flat out outlaw abortion, what's left for you in the U.S. House to do?
Well, we will continue our work. Certainly, I was just talking with a colleague last night, Craig, remembering our dear colleague and friend, John Lewis, who reminded us always to never give up, never give in, keep the faith, and keep your eyes on the prize. And I can hear him saying that in my head right now. We are not going to give up on protecting the rights of women and families across this country. And like I said before, this decision is a radical decision from the Supreme Court. But as you pointed out, there have been a lot of efforts over the years to chip away at the rights that Roe guarantees. And of course, as we all know, Roe is a balancing test to address exactly what you said, that people support abortion and there's sort of a continuum. But this country, by and large, is pro-choice by large majorities, 75% of the country, and in some places higher. And so it's really important that people use their voice when they vote and make that clear. But there are laws on the books in Texas that are set to go into effect if Roe v. Wade is in fact overturned in the Supreme Court. Texas has a trigger law that would make performing an abortion a felony that goes into effect 30 days after the Supreme Court overturns Roe. And of course, we've been living since September in not an entirely post-Roe world, but a very difficult situation here in Texas. And I've talked to abortion care providers, I've talked to obstetricians and gynecologists about the challenges, the incredibly real challenges that their patients are experiencing. People who have ectopic pregnancies, which is certain to kill a woman if she is not able to have an abortion. That's a pregnancy where the egg is implanted in your fallopian tubes, right? That pregnancy cannot go forward. But under these laws, we are going to see these laws that are being passed in Texas and states across the country don't allow exceptions for rape or incest or the life and health of the mother. And many, many women seeking abortion care already have children. We are talking about something so extreme, it's almost unfathomable. And that's what Roe represents, this balancing of individual autonomy and dignity and making these choices in consultation with your family, with your doctor and healthcare providers about what's best for families in Texas and across the country. And I think that we are set to see a series of things go into effect. We've heard leaders in the state of Texas say just this week that not only do they want to make abortion illegal in Texas, they want to make it illegal for Texans to obtain abortions in other states, to make it possible for people to travel somewhere else. And it's certainly not everyone in Texas is able to do that. But for those who are able to travel to another state, they want to make that illegal too. So what we're talking about is really an extreme position that is not supported by the majority of Texans. And what the Supreme Court has said now in sending it back to the states and saying this is not an issue for the courts is that it matters who we send to Austin and who we send to Washington and who's going to ensure that the rights that we have experienced as Americans for the last 50 years are protected and preserved.
Taylor is in Bel Air. Taylor, what's your question for Congresswoman Lizzie Fletcher?
Hi, Congressman. I was curious on your thoughts about if this ruling goes through, what effect it will have realistically on other Supreme Court rulings and how far this could potentially go. Will it just stop at abortion and perhaps contraception, or do you think they'd be willing to take this further with other previous rulings?
Well, certainly what I've seen in this draft framework lays the groundwork to undo many of the rights and protections that we not only enjoy, but expect as Americans and certainly as Texans. Right now, you're hearing some people say this is just abortion. But if you look at the cases that are cited in this draft opinion, going back to Griswold, which I mentioned, which gives, again, married couples the right to use birth control. You also see a whole line of cases come out of this implied right to privacy in the Constitution that the justices in Roe recognized. And that runs from decisions in the 1960s all the way to recent years. So I think everything is on the table that emerges from that right to privacy. And I think that it's important for people to know that it has the potential to undo prior precedent. And we've seen, unfortunately, from the Supreme Court, if they were to reverse Roe, it calls into question all of those cases that follow that same right of privacy, that individual liberty that is implied in the Constitution and in our right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
We're talking with Houston area Congresswoman Lizzie Fletcher. We'll take more of your questions at talk@houstonmatters.org or 713-440-8870 as Houston Matters continues. This is Houston Matters. I'm Craig Cohen. We're talking with Houston area Congresswoman Lizzie Fletcher, and we welcome you to our conversation at 713-440-8870 or talk@houstonmatters.org. Let's go next to Lucille. Lucille, what's your question for the Congresswoman?
Okay. Good morning. I want to know if Representative Fletcher knows how much a living wage is, and also, if so, where did she get the information?
All right, thanks for the call. Congresswoman?
Well, thanks for the question, Lucille. And this is certainly something we talk about a lot in Congress, especially as we have seen the incredible challenges over the last 2 years during the coronavirus pandemic. There is a distinction, kind of a regional distinction, across the country in terms of affordability, but we know that everything is getting more expensive across the country, from housing to groceries and gasoline. And these have been things we've been talking about in Congress. When it comes to wages, certainly I have supported the efforts to raise the minimum wage across the country. There have been a lot of different proposals to do that, but many groups and many advocates have said and fought very hard for a minimum wage of $15 an hour. Certainly there are, even then, what we know is that the minimum wage that we have right now barely puts families above the poverty level, and in some cases does not. So we know that we need to increase the minimum wage to make sure that hardworking families are able to have a living wage and to be able to provide for themselves and their families. So that is a real priority in Congress. It's why we have had pandemic assistance that I have voted for at every opportunity that Congress has passed important legislation to help people as they lost their jobs, as they experienced other challenges throughout the pandemic. And I think it's really important for all of us to make sure that our communities can thrive. And one of the most important ways to be able to do that is to make sure that those who live and work in our communities are able to support themselves and their families. And so living wage is very, very important and a priority of this Congress, and certainly of the last that I've served in and will continue to be for me and for my colleagues.
We go next to Benjamin in Meyerland. Benjamin, what's your question for Congresswoman Fletcher?
Hello, Ms. Fletcher. Good morning. I work in a school, and we were wondering how we could possibly access funds to improve the air quality of our school. I know this is a big issue. It's come up since COVID, the onset of COVID, and also for other health reasons. And so we're wondering how we could access that and improve the air quality for our students and our faculty.
Yes, a great question, and something that we're very focused on here in Houston, of course, with the various challenges we have in ozone days, and air quality is really important. We have several programs and proposals that are moving largely through. Of course, there's the regulatory side on the federal government, making sure that states and localities are in compliance with air quality standards. So that's really important. And then also funding kinds of programs to do research to help improve air quality and put in place new technologies to help address that. For me, for example, I just introduced a bill to try to capture emissions at refineries, something that would certainly benefit our community here and people across the country if we could capture those emissions and then use them, capture the carbon dioxide emissions and then sequester them or use them to address climate change as well as air quality. But a lot of different programs coming through. Federal government programs go into the state funds to be administered by the state, and I would be happy to connect anyone who's looking to see what kind of grant programs and other things might be available. We have information in our office and members of my team. We have a big team that works for the 7th Congressional District to make sure that we can look for access to federal grant programs and other kinds of things to help. So would be glad to connect you with my office. That number in Houston is 713-353-8680. And we have a great team here in Houston as well as a team up in Washington that's dedicated to helping people across our community and would be glad to do that.
Tom writes, sincere thanks for organizing the virtual community conversation on flood mitigation and recovery on April 14th. He says it's very encouraging to see increased cooperation at the local, state, and federal levels. In the latest federal budget, you got some $13 million allocated for a few things in your district, including flood mitigation projects. Can you tell us a bit about those projects?
Sure, I'd be glad to, because I'm really excited about it. The flood mitigation project, the big one, was actually the largest project funding that we got. We got about $9.9 million for Harris County flood control in this most recent appropriations bill we passed in March. And that is for the planning and construction of the Meyer Grove Detention Basin, which is on North Braeswood, just inside the loop. And it's going to be used to design and construct a 7.5-acre stormwater detention basin. It's going to hold more than 50 million gallons of stormwater away from the homes and businesses that are in that area that are subject to repeat flooding from Harvey, Tax Day, Memorial Day, just upstream of the medical center. Really, really important flood reduction. And so I'm very excited about that project. I got to announce it on the banks of Braes Bio with Harris County Flood Control and other community leaders. Mayor Turner was there. Council member came in, just people across our community there to celebrate that. And we're supposed to break ground this fall, and it should be completed next year. So it's great to see that effort underway and really moving. And we were able to bring federal dollars here to do that through this community funded projects program. A couple of other things that I was able to ask for, and this is a program where members of Congress can go to our appropriators and say, here are real priorities for my community. I would like to get these funded. And it's a transparent process. Everything I've asked for is outlined on my website so people can see what I've asked for. I think that's an important piece of the process, is the transparency. But I was very lucky that I got everything I asked for. And that included nearly $1 million, I think $975,000 for the Houston Police Department for burn justice assistant grants that are going to support the employment of 9 full-time crime victim advocates. As I understand it, those will hopefully largely help in domestic violence cases and other really important crime victim assistance here in Houston. Another $900,000 for the City of Houston Health Department to purchase a new ambulance mobile stroke unit that will respond more quickly and appropriately to stroke victims here in our community. We've had one, and now this is a chance to bring back this mobile stroke unit that's really a specialized ambulance with the expertise to diagnose and assist patients having strokes before they get to the hospital. In addition, we also got funding for the City of Houston Fire Department to support the Emergency Telehealth and Navigation Project, the EFIN project, and that provides mobile technology to connect EMTs at the fire department to care for emergency patients with conditions that aren't life-threatening, with connecting them with emergency physicians who have access to primary care resources. So that's really important. And then two more I'll touch on that are that are more infrastructure projects, again, kind of going back to flooding and our water systems, water conveyance. Last week when I was home, I had the joy of going out to Jersey Village in my district to join with Mayor Warren and Representative John Rosenthal and others to announce that I got $625,000 for a full street reconstruction of Seattle Street in Jersey Village that's going to replace water lines for about 55 homes and will help address flooding there. And then another $782,000 for the city of Bel Air to address their deficient waterline infrastructure and improve water distribution and wastewater collection systems in Bel Air. So these are all communities and towns in the 7th Congressional District. And some, of course, are citywide benefits in Houston Police Department, Houston Fire Department. But it's really exciting to be able to do this. I think each of these projects is going to provide really important and needed improvements that are going to have a real impact on people in our community. So I'm glad to be able to support my district's priorities in this way. And we're just entering into that process for this year. So hopefully we will have more information on what we're able to do this year very soon.
Congresswoman Michael in Copperfield is frustrated about what he says are low-flying jets out of Bush Airport causing increasingly unacceptable noise pollution. He says, I've been living here for 30 years and it's getting so bad I can't go out and enjoy the outdoors because every several minutes a jet comes low, spreading the high decibel noise levels skyrocketing. How can you help, please?
You know, that's the first I'm hearing of this. Certainly glad to help and see what I can do. I'm in regular conversation. I actually just did a tour at Bush Airport a couple of weeks ago when I came home to see the improvements because, of course, the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act provides funding for our airports, in addition to the Port of Houston, where we just got $142 million grant in January of this year to begin the widening and deepening project. And of course, as you know, hopefully everyone has heard by now, roads, bridges, broadband, water infrastructure, there's a lot in that bill, including funding for our airports. So I've been in contact with folks at the Houston Airport System, and I'm of course in touch as well with air traffic control, and I'd be glad to look into that. So please, please do. Again, I gave my number for my office earlier. You can find me. You can also send information through my website, which is fletcher.house.gov, and certainly happy to address concerns. And that's one thing I'd love to mention, Craig, is something we do in our office all the time. And I think it's something not everybody knows, that we're here to help anybody with federal agencies in our district. And so whether it's immigration issues or Social Security, veterans benefits, certainly we helped a lot with PPP loans, SBA loans, dealing with issues with the IRS, all kinds of things where you're dealing with a federal agency. My team and I are here to help with that. And we have just closed this summer our 8,000th case for our constituents. So it's something I'm just really proud that we're able to do. And like I said, it's all kinds of things. Most recently, one of the things I'm so glad we've been able to do is directly assist several Ukrainian families in expediting their immigration cases before the U.S. Immigration Service. And I think it's just really important for people to know that we are here to help, and I'm certainly here to help in all the ways that I can.
Congresswoman Lizzie Fletcher is a Democrat representing the Texas 7th District. Congresswoman, I know you have to go. Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks so much, Craig. Great to be with you as always.
And still to come, a new poll is out this morning highlighting how important healthcare access is to Texans. We'll learn more. Plus, why the mother of a transgender teen moved her family out of Texas. Stay with us as Houston Matters continues. Many families of transgender children no longer feel safe living in Texas. In the last year, state lawmakers banned trans kids from playing on sports teams that match their gender identity, and the governor ordered child welfare officers to investigate families providing gender-affirming care to their kids based on Attorney General Ken Paxton's claim that it's child abuse. Courts put a halt to that, though not before some investigations began. News 88.7 health reporter Sarah Willa Ernst has been talking with parents of trans children, including Rachel, mother to a non-binary child and transgender teen on hormone therapy. After watching this all play out over months, Rachel moved her family out of Texas last month.
I can't help but when people check in with me, like, I'm very honest. I'm like, well, I have these worries on my mind and I'm starting to think about leaving the state. And people are like, well, if you ever need someplace to stay, you know, you can come to our place, and just kind of like sticking those in my brain. And I mean, I literally had them all over the country from coast to coast. You know, we're really lucky and we have a good support system, but also we're not, you know, other people are worried, have been worried about what's happening and want to make sure they're doing something. And just kind of thinking like, okay, well, if I just need an emergency, I can go to this place. Or if I know I'm moving into this area, then I can go to this place. This place is going to be the best for my kids. This place is a good, oh my gosh, I'm just panicking and leaving. And this is all just happening in the background in my brain. It's not even like my forefront of my planning.
Okay. So that was kind of like the first phase of the moving process. When did things kind of ramp up a little bit and start moving from conversations and big plans to something a little bit more concrete?
Mm-hmm. So I think, not that it was good timing, because none of this is good, but we, again, we're kind of lucky and we'd narrowed it down to three places. And we were just about to leave to go visit the third place when the directive from Paxton came out. And it was really panicky. And then it was like, oh, maybe it's going to be okay. And then it was really panicky. Like nobody really knew what was going on. It took a couple of weeks for everyone to figure out how serious it was going to be. And right before we left is when it was like, oh no, this is for real. Like they're going to make this happen. This is a really serious threat. So we're leaving to go visit our third place. And I'm thinking in my brain, like, I think when I get back, I may need to put my kids in the car and leave. And the plan is always like, I take the kids and my husband stays, for a little while. And it's, you know, it's this really chaotic plan that we've kind of loosely established as the emergency getaway plan. But yeah, like, I guess that was the beginning of March and it was right as we were leaving to go visit that third place. So as soon as we came back, I was like, okay, it's like, we have to sit down and talk this out. We have to figure out what we're doing because we need to do something now. And I don't know if now means this week or if now means in the next month or two, but we need to figure out what feels safe and how big of a risk we're willing to take with our kids. So that was right after we got back from that last trip. And we came back and like immediately that weekend had some really serious talks about what timeline we felt comfortable with. And at the end of the day, it really just came down to like, how much are we willing to risk? You know, what happens if we get reported? Is that something that we want to live with? And it's such an unknown. So we decided that we wanted to go quickly. There were a couple of things we wanted to finish up in the state and be responsible for. And so, you know, it gave us like a couple weeks. And I decided that it was in our best interest to like get out of the house, get the house on the market, because it takes time to do all of this stuff. You know, it takes time to sell your house and close, find another, especially in this market, find another house. Like, it's fast to sell your house in this market, but to find another house is a huge burden right now. And especially like moving into states that do have better legislative protections for people, those states are often more expensive, and major cities are more expensive, and that's where healthcare is in major cities. So it's a really big undertaking. So I decided that I wanted to get out of the house, get it sold as quickly as possible so that we had the best opportunities to move, get out of the state and move forward with everything else that had to happen.
Rachel, a mother with a non-binary child and transgender teen who moved her family out of Texas last month. She spoke with News 88.7 Sarah Willa Ernst, who joins us now. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, good morning.
Rachel began planning her family's move out of Texas when state lawmakers passed that bill banning trans kids from playing on sports teams matching their gender identity. Why did that bill in particular jumpstart her decision to leave the state?
I think at that moment, it really signaled that state lawmakers weren't kidding around. No longer were these bills targeting trans youth hypothetical threats, but they were now laws on the books. And you have to remember, at that point, these families had gone through months of uncertainty. I mean, the legislative session where there were a lot of bills targeting trans people began in January 2021. So by October, it had been building for months, and you can imagine it took a toll on her family.
Hey, I was wondering if she faced any pushback from family members over the move.
One thing that she really emphasized over and over again was just how supportive her support system is. And that also included family members. When she decided to leave Texas, actually, she stayed with family members for a while, which was just a huge, huge help. And that's just a privilege that not everybody has. She didn't have to rush into signing a lease or putting an offer on a house. You know, they could be a little bit more intentional with their decisions.
And of course, the other big piece in all of this is that opinion from Attorney General Ken Paxton, followed by the order from Governor Abbott for child welfare officials to begin investigating families of trans children who offer gender-affirming care. Did Rachel think she'd face an investigation from CPS?
She thought it was possible. All the families I've talked to have thought it's possible and have prepared for that possibility. She created an escape plan, just like the other families I've talked to. You know, if these bills pass last year or if the courts don't block, you know, Governor Abbott's directive, what do they do? You know, how does she protect her kids? And, you know, she compiled a list of places they could go to, you know, couches they could surf on, even somebody's basement who promised that they, you know, nobody would know that they were living there. And, you know, she imagined telling her kids to pack 2 weeks of clothes, hop in the car and just drive to the safest location.
It's a rather frustrating, I'm sure, scenario to be thinking about. As a parent, that you might have to just pack up and leave and not really know exactly where you're going.
I think it's terrifying for a lot of families. And I think as a result, that's why people are thinking of leaving.
News 88.7 health reporter Sarah Willa Ernst. Sarah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
A new poll out just this morning conducted by the Episcopal Health Foundation finds healthcare affordability is a high priority for most Texans. Brian Sasser, Chief Communications Officer for the Episcopal Health Foundation, tells our William Menjivar why healthcare access remains a critical concern year after year.
We've done this poll several years now, and every year it seems Texans are looking to lawmakers and state officials to help solve some serious health problems. And it seems like affordability and being able to access care and access health insurance always rise to the top of the list of concerns for Texans when it comes to health. And so I think what the poll is showing, as far as 76% saying making healthcare more affordable is very important for candidates to address, I think this shows the importance of what they believe, that those issues are serious and that these are the people who may be able to help fix those issues.
How many people in Texas are uninsured?
The numbers, you know, vary greatly depending on kind of what poll you look at and what numbers you look at, but it's roughly 5 million Texans. It varies between those who don't have jobs to be able to get insurance, those who are undocumented. There's lots of different issues there. But Texas leads the nation in the number of uninsured residents and leads the nation in the rate of uninsured. And that is something that has not changed for a long time.
But why do so many Texans lack access to health insurance and health care?
Well, there's various reasons, primarily because most people get their health insurance through their job. And when you don't have a job that offers health insurance, it's tougher to afford it. And I think that Medicaid expansion in Texas would allow roughly 1 million Texans to be able to get affordable health care through Medicaid. That was part of the Affordable Care Act. And Texas is one of 12 states that did not expand Medicaid. That is one solution to the problem. But I think what our survey continues to show now is that those who don't have insurance, 83% say it's difficult for them to pay for health care. And so we've said a long time, and we've said this many times, while health insurance is not the magic pill to being healthy, it sure is a key piece of the puzzle. And in Texas, that's a tougher piece to fill than any other state.
So what effect is this having on Texans, this lack of health care and lack of access to health insurance? Are Texans putting off care?
Sure. I mean, so half of those surveyed, 48%, said it's somewhat or very difficult for them to afford care. It's one of the hardest necessities for them to afford. Only gasoline and transportation costs rank higher. And then when it comes to skipping care, 59% of Texans said they skipped or postponed care because of costs. That's up for a little bit from 2020, primarily because people didn't seek care as much during COVID in 2020. The rates for 2021 are pretty similar to the ones we had in 2019 and 2018. And when you look at the uninsured, those rates go even higher. So they're more likely to say the 83% say it's tough for them to pay for health care of those who aren't insured compared to just 38% of those with health insurance. They're most likely to have difficulty paying their medical bills. And 78% of uninsured Texans said they skipped or postponed care in the last year. That's compared to 56% of Texans with health insurance. So it's a big deal for skipping care is a big deal, and postponing care is a big deal for those with health insurance. But if you don't have health insurance, the issue is that much bigger.
What kind of health care are people postponing?
The poll didn't ask specific questions, but we've heard in the past is when it comes to, you know, those with insurance and those without health insurance, that people without insurance are most likely to skip preventative care. So that's the care, you know, the regular checkups and those kind of things, because it's covered under health insurance, but you have to pay out of pocket if you don't have health insurance. So while the poll doesn't go into specifics, we know that's a big issue between uninsured and insured. And that's also, you know, why most people who don't have insurance may not go to the doctor until they really have to, until they're sick. So your more expensive care, your health is worse, and it's further down the line. So that's one of the benefits of having health insurance is, you know, those preventative care is covered, and that's a big issue for your health.
What do Texans think about Medicaid expansion?
Yeah, so we've asked the same question several years, and the support for Medicaid expansion continues to grow. 69% of Texans said they support Medicaid expansion. That's about the same as last year and up a little bit, 64%. The numbers were in 2018 and 2019. So a majority of Texans say they want it, and I think they'd say they want it because they see the benefits of it. And again, more than a million Texans would likely benefit from Medicaid expansion. It's mostly hardworking, low-income Texans who have jobs, who are working, but just don't have insurance through their employer and cannot get Affordable Care Act marketplace health insurance because the subsidies don't apply to them. So it's a big gap there. And so 69% of Texans say they support Medicaid expansion. And I think that's a pretty consistent number we've seen throughout the years.
Is this lack of health care affecting certain groups more than others here in Texas?
Sure. So obviously those without health insurance say it's more difficult to afford care. If you look at race and ethnicity, 45% of Black Texans say it's difficult for them to afford care compared to 41% of white Texans. And then 58% of Hispanic Texans say it's difficult to afford care. When it comes to skipping or postponing care, the numbers, Black Texans, 63% say they've skipped or postponed care due to cost compared to 57% for white Texans and 61% for Hispanic Texans. But it really comes down to uninsured and insured, and income plays a primary role in that too. So you can look at it a lot of different ways, but those low income, younger, uninsured had the most difficulty affording care and also are the most likely to skip care.
What can lawmakers do to address these problems?
I think they just need to look at the numbers and look at what are the options to provide health insurance coverage for Texans who are low income and working. And whether that's Medicaid expansion, whether that's expanding the Affordable Care Act to allow those with lower incomes to be able to get subsidies and help to pay their premiums. But I think this is a consistent issue, and it's an economic issue too. It's not just a health issue. Obviously, we believe, and the studies show that you'd be healthier if you have insurance and you're able to see the doctor and you don't postpone care. But it's also an economic problem, because if you're sick and you can't get care and you postpone care, then you get sicker, you miss work, then companies suffer. So I think what the studies have shown and what we've shown through this poll and through others is that Medicaid expansion, expanding health insurance coverage, or finding through the ACA, or finding some sort of Texas plan to offer health insurance coverage to them is a health benefit and a financial benefit, both to the people who would be able to get this insurance and to the state as a whole.
That's Brian Sasser, Chief Communications Officer for the Houston-based Episcopal Health Foundation. He spoke with Houston Matters' William Menhivar. Still to come, the late Mickey Gilley recalls Urban Cowboy, his Pasadena honky tonk, and his legacy. Stay with us as Houston Matters continues. Mickey Gilley's death Saturday reminded us of how much influence he had in the Houston area and across the nation. Gilley had 17 number one country hits. Some remember him as one of three famous cousins. The others were fellow singer Jerry Lee Lewis and televangelist Jimmy Swaggart. But really, Gilley's legacy was cemented by the 1980 film Urban Cowboy, shot in the Houston area and featuring his original Gilley's Bar and Country Dance Hall in Pasadena. Upwards of 6,000 people would routinely pile into Gilley's, drawn by country music, cowboy culture, and of course that mechanical bull. In 2020, ICU's Eddie Robinson spoke with Mickey Gilley about the singer's legacy, about the film Urban Cowboy, and the origin of the honky-tonk that bore his name.
Give us a sweet honky-tonk wine. Don't you know that it keeps me out of my mind?
I played a club down the street from where Gilley's was located. I worked there for 10 years. And we were very successful in the club, you know, because every time my cousin Jerry Lee would have a hit, I could do his music pretty close to him. So the people would come out and listen to me perform and play the piano and sing and that type of thing. And lo and behold, I got a better offer and went across town. And a gentleman by the name of Sherwood Cryer came over and talked to me about coming back into Pasadena and taking the old club called Shelley's. And he asked me, you know, if I would come into business with him, he'd give me half the club and that type of thing. And he asked me what I wanted to call it. And I said, well, it's your club. You can call it whatever you like. And he says, I want to call it Gilley's. And when he said that, I said, wow, man, Gilley's. Had my name in lights. So I knew he was going to put a neon sign out front, you know, because it had Shelley's out there and it lit up at night. And he put the Gilley name on it. And it's become a brand name, you know, because we got the film The Urban Cowboy. I would have never installed a mechanical bull in that club. He surprised me when I came in. And he'd put the mechanical bull in. That's what really turned all the things around for all of us, is because I had the hit song back in 1974 that went national, my first number one record in the national scene with Room Full of Roses.
If I sent a rose to you, while every time you made me blue, you'd have a room full of roses.
And then, of course, then he said he wanted to try to attract the people from the Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo and the Pasadena Rodeo. And he put the mechanical bull in as something that would attract the people coming in. But the rodeo and the plant workers, you know, come out to ride the mechanical bull. And lo and behold, we get this guy from New York City by the name of Aaron Latham coming down to see what all the hoopla was about this mechanical contraption we had in a nightclub. I said, well, it's a rodeo training device is what it was, you know. It wasn't ever meant to be in an entertainment establishment. But lo and behold, you know, everybody's coming out, and that's what it was a big talk about. And the next thing I knew, you know, we had this article come out in Esquire magazine, and he called it The Battle of the Urban Cowboy. First of all, I didn't like the article because I thought he was making fun of the country music scene. And me and Sherwood Cryer was on our way out to California at the time, and I think I was going to do the Mike Douglas show. Or it could have been the Merv Griffin. But anyway, it was one of those shows, talk show. We were flying out there together, and Cryer said to me, he said, look, I know you didn't like the article in Esquire magazine. Don't say anything bad about it because we might get a movie. And at that time, I told him, I said, what side of the bed did you roll off on? And he said, no, I'm serious. They're looking at John Travolta to play the part. And when he said John Travolta, all of a sudden it dawned on me, you know, here's John Travolta to do that film. I'm looking at Saturday Night Fever, Country Night Fever.
This place beer in my whole town.
Yeah, it's the biggest honky-tonk in the world. 3.5 acres of concrete prairie in here.
I never dreamed it was going to explode into what it became, because 40 years later, me and Johnny Lee are still doing the music soundtrack film Urban Cowboy and having a great time.
Did you see Urban Cowboy as sort of like a two-hour advertisement for Gilley's?
No, I never looked at it that way. The only thing that I'll say is that when they give me the preview of the film out in Hollywood, I walked out and I told my business partner in the PR firm at the time, I told Mr. Cryer, and I walked out and I said, Johnny Lee will have a smash hit. It'll be a number one record for him. They said, well, I said, Looking for Love will be a number one song for him. Just because John Travolta said, turn that song up.
Well, turn that up, will you? That's my favorite song.
I was looking for love in all the wrong places.
Sure enough, it exploded off of the charts.
Yep.
And became the hottest song in the film. Although I thought my favorite tune in there was Boss Gags.
Love, look what you've done to me.
did such a great job on that song, and I love that song. Exactly. And then, of course, Ann Murray had a great song. Can I
have this dance?
Could I have this dance for the rest of my life? Would you be my partner every night?
Any amazing stories you can share with us regarding the filming of the movie? You know, any kind of, you know, some interesting sort of like memories that you remember during the production of the filming?
To give you an example of what I knew about acting, if you see the scene when they first walk into the club and the guy says, that's Gilly, he owns half the club or something like that, and I'm playing the piano. So I didn't know at the time that when they walked in, the music was going to drop, and I've got to continue to mimic the song. I got to be faking the piano, and I got to fake my vocal. So if I'm in a shot, you get me singing. You follow what I'm saying?
Wow.
So anyway, I didn't know this at the time.
Uh-huh.
This is action. More smoke and action. And this music starts, so I'm at the piano, and I'm singing Sweet Honky Tonk Wine. And when the music drops and they come into the dialogue, I just turned around on the piano stoop, and I'm sitting there listening to them talk. And the producer walks up. Jim Bridges walks over. He's the one that also did China Syndrome, too, you know. But
yeah,
Jim
wow.
Bridges was the producer. He comes
director.
Over, and he says, hey, Gilly, you think you could fake that song a little bit closer? He said, you might be in that shot. That's what I do about acting and what
right.
they were doing, you know.
That's so fascinating.
It didn't take me long to straighten my act up. And I knew when I had to fake the song, I had to stay on top of it all the way through.
Thank you, everybody, and welcome to Gilly. Good to have you all with us.
Why do you think the film resonates with so many people?
You know, that's a great question, and I wish I could answer that for you truthfully. My perspective of it is because it was so different than anything that anybody had ever seen, you know. Here's a big nightclub with a mechanical contraption in it that people are having a good time on, and all these plant workers are coming over, you know, and you're getting to see what Houston's really all about, and you're getting to see this love story behind the scene, too, and the dancing. And the music, I thought, was pretty darn different, you know, for a film like that. There was just a lot of good music in there.
Mickey Gilly, what kind of legacy would you like to leave behind as a result of what you've gone through in your career?
Well, I hope that people look back and see that I was a good person, that I tried to present the music that I love and enjoy, and I try to do the best I can every time I walk out on stage, do the best performance that I can. I try to do an entertaining type performance. And I hope that I leave a brand name of Gilly's out there for everybody to enjoy. And I hope that the people that have the clubs with the Gilly logo on it are happy with the fact that they can go and have a good time and enjoy themselves. So if I do that, it makes me a happy camper.
Darling, stand by me. Won't you stand by me?
We heard country singer Mickey Gilly there talking with News 88.7's Eddie Robinson back in 2020 on the 40th anniversary of the film Urban Cowboy, which was shot at Gilly's Pasadena nightclub. Gilly died Saturday at the age of 86. And that'll do it for today's show. The Houston Matters team includes Michael Haggerty, Joshua Zinn, Troy Schultz, and William Menhivar. Jared Carroll was our technical director today. On tomorrow's show, this week's political roundup, of course. We do that every Wednesday. Also, a new biography explores how DJ Screw created a sound that was uniquely Houstonian. Plus, West Texas A&M's orchestra performs a professor's film score for a screening of Charlie Chaplin's The Kid. I'm Craig Cohen. Join us tomorrow for those and other Houston Matters.
Houston Public Media.